Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. Today, it's my happiness to welcome Molly Ann Lakin to the Morning Glory Project. Molly came to California from Canada with her baritone ukulele to become a songwriter in Hollywood at a time when women were rare in the field. She was told that nobody listens to lyrics. She was told she wasn't beautiful, so nobody would want her. But she refused to leave. She'd go on to become an award-winning songwriter, with her songs being recorded by pop and country artists on the Billboard charts, from Katy Perry, Glen Campbell, to Karen Carpenter, Cher, Tina Turner, Anne Murray, John Travolta, Placido Domingo, plus, and get this might be the best one, Yitzy Yaya and the Yo-Yos. For 10 years, Molly was a staff writer at three major publishing companies, and she wrote themes and songs for over six dozen TV shows and movies, including Violet, which won an Oscar. Molly was nominated for an Emmy, and her songs have been recorded by all kinds of folks. Recently, she collaborated with Katy Perry on the I Love Local Business in the 805 song and wrote the official English language lyric for, Hatikva, the national anthem of Israel. Is it, I get it right?
Close. Hatikva. We stress the second syllable.
I put the accent on the wrong syllable.
There. Well, you fixed it.
Wonderful. Molly is the author of 8 books on songwriting, and although she's single, she's waitlisted once again for Brad Pitt. Molly, thank you so much for being part of the Morning Glory Project. I'm happy to have you here today.
Well, it's fun, Betsy. I'm glad we hooked up.
So, Molly, I want to go back in time to the 70s when you came to California as a songwriter, and indeed as a female songwriter, and kind of set the scene for me. What was that scene like for you, and what was the vibe at the time? There, I'm going to use all kinds of 70s language now. I'll have to get a hip and a groovy in there, I guess. But tell me what the vibe was at the time, and particularly for women as songwriters.
Well, first, I defected from Canada in a 59 degree below zero blizzard, and I drove my little red Volkswagen across country, and I didn't know anybody in California except one lady. Well, then she was a girlfriend in Encino, and I stayed with them, and her mother didn't want me to find a job or have a career. She just wanted me to get married, and I said, well, that's fine, but I do write songs. Well, he's a nice accountant. I said, that's nice, but he's dull as dirt. I want to have a career. Well, why don't you just marry somebody and then you don't need a career? And I said, I'd like to have a career. So first it was the mother, right? I had to battle with her. Then Hollywood. I earned my living as a social worker, an emergency intake social worker. And the county was ridiculous in terms of making payments on an emergency basis to unwed mothers or single moms and their kids. So it used to take 6 weeks for a client of mine to get a check. And then when Governor Reagan took over and installed the computer system, it didn't take 6 weeks anymore. It took 12. So that's what was going on there. And fortunately, I could write down that I was making home calls to see my clients when, in fact, I was going to Hollywood to see music publishers. And when I walked in my little mini dress, and I glued on my eyelashes in the car, and I put on my boots that were made for walking, and I walked in with the ukulele and sang flat, they thought I was the Gong Show. And they called in their whole staff, hey, listen to this. This is the Gong Show. And of course I was horrified and heartbroken. Marry a dentist. You're a nice girl. What do you need with this? I said, I want to write songs. So I went to see every single lowlife publisher in Hollywood. And I worked my way up from the fourth-rate ones whose offices were in phone booths on Selma to the guys in Hollywood above the 7-Eleven and so on, till I got to the real music publishers, the Menches, who understood good writing and didn't care if a woman wrote lyrics. It was okay.
Yeah, it wasn't like you were auditioning as a singer. You were just showing them the songs you wrote, right?
Correct. And I sang flat, so one guy made me promise never to sing within 100 yards of him or he'd duck my weekly advance.
Well, so here you are, a Canadian expat of sorts. And what is it? Where did you get that drive that you just simply had to be a songwriter?
I wasn't any good at anything else. I had a degree in French literature and I didn't want to teach. And the choices then were minimal. You either became a teacher, a nurse, or a wife. And I wasn't really interested in teaching and in nursing. So I needed a career and nobody was breaking down the door to marry me. And my mother said I wasn't beautiful, so nobody would marry me. So I needed to have a career. And this, I was good at this. I was really good at this. I mean, nobody rocked Michael Row the Boat Ashore better than me. even the very best singer-songwriters out there.
So you started writing, and you say that you slid in the side door. Tell me about that. How did you get? Because these are a lot of obstacles, and I think that younger listeners, if I'm fortunate enough to have some, particularly young women, may not know that there were just times when women just were not welcomed, period. They'd say, look, we got to give this job to a man. He has a family to feed. You don't. Or just that they couldn't even fathom the idea of a woman holding that particular job. And it sounds like you were on the cusp of that era change.
Yes. Each label had one token female artist. And that was it. And no matter how good you were, how promising you were, women were not good candidates to be signed to labels because A, they didn't want to travel, and B, the chances were good that they'd get pregnant and want to stay home with the baby.
Well, that was the perception.
That was the perception. And so it never occurred to anybody that you could do both. So that's the way it was. Songwriting, mainstream songwriting, there were two categories. There was rock and roll, noisy rock and roll, and there were beautiful songs, and I wrote beautiful songs. And at my publisher's office, there was a big blackboard listing all the artists looking for songs that week and the specifications. Even as crazy as it must have an ooh at the end of the line, because that's her best note. I thought, what? Anyway, I went home. I did my assignment. I came back. The publisher said, no, not quite. And I go home. I do it again. And he was really impressed with the fact that I stuck to it. And there was a songwriter meeting on Fridays at Warner Brothers Music. I was driving in Hollywood, trying to get to the business manager of the alleged deadbeat dad of my client's kids. And they all said that either Elvis or Paul McCartney or the guy from the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, was the father of the baby. So I had to go to see the business managers to try to get some child support.
So wait, let me back this up. So you're doing the legit social work stuff that
Correct.
You needed to do for trying to get payments from supposedly deadbeat dads. And these moms all claimed that these rock stars were their daddy, which I'm gathering. I don't know whether it was true or not. It doesn't matter, I guess. But that let you then have to contact the business managers of those stars?
I contacted the business managers. I told them who I was, where I was from. They chuckled, and they actually made meetings with me. And of course, I slept along my baritone ukulele and put on my little mini dress and my boots and glued on my eyelashes, because you never know. And I didn't ever get a dime from any of the alleged deadbeat dads. But on the way to their office, I found this line on Hollywood Boulevard of scruffy-looking people with guitars entering Warner Brothers Music. And I rolled down the window. What's going on here? Oh, we have a regular Friday afternoon meeting for all songwriters. Everybody's welcome. So I thought, welcome? Somebody's welcoming me? And I just parked in a tow-way zone and walked in. Never mind my client or the deadbeat dad. I just walked in. Here I am. I'm a songwriter. And this publisher could sense my passion, could sense how badly I wanted this. And he never threw me out. He just said, rewrite it, rewrite it, rewrite it. And I tell you, Betsy, he had me rewrite the chorus to one song for 6 months. I used to drive up to the top of the hill at the Getty Center in the garden, and I sit there with my pen and rewrite and rewrite. And finally, that song became my first country hit, Silver Wings and Golden Rings. Were it not for that publisher, I'd probably still be chasing down deadbeat dads at the county.
And who recorded that?
It was a big hit for Billy Joe Spears, who was a very big country artist at the time, and Cher did it later.
Well, that's what I thought. I thought I recalled it as a Cher song, and I thought I was making that up in my head. Well, so Molly, I mean, this is one of those fun, how I got discovered kinds of stories, and I love that. And clearly, you are just a beyond tenacious person. But I'm wondering, what was the hard stuff? What were the moments that you thought you wouldn't be able to make it?
Well, everybody said nobody listens to lyrics, so why bother sharing a copyright with a lyricist?
You mostly wrote lyrics.
At that time, I did, and I was collaborating with these guys who wrote symphonies, and my God. And so the lyrics were important because the singers had a gorgeous melody, and it wasn't just ya-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, baby. Real lyrics. My songs say something. But the rest, everybody was interested in rock and roll and something. Give me something you can dance to. My publisher actually sawed a hole in the carpet in his office and had them install a circular dance floor. And when you put on a tape on his player, he'd start dancing. And if he couldn't get lost in it, he'd take out the tape. He wouldn't just take it out. He'd snip it in half. So give me something you can dance to. Well, I didn't write songs you could dance to. I wrote songs you could dream to. And eventually they started And I had a whole bunch of country hits before anybody in L.A. knew I was even here.
I'm wondering, at those times, I mean, I'm a writer, and I always say that when somebody buys a book for $16.95, they have no idea how many hundreds of versions there were of that book before that, you know, and that it seems like it's an absolute bargain in my mind. And I think now I'm thinking of you musically and thinking, you know, 6 months of rewriting on a song that, had it not finally gone forward, you'd have been paid nothing for that. So songs are taking a good deal of time. It takes a certain something to keep you going back to get it right. And I'm wondering where you find that. How do you access that in yourself?
This was my gift. I knew it. I knew it before I knew I had a gift. I often tried when things were the worst. okay, I'm going to get another job. Maybe I'll go into advertising. Boring. Maybe I'll work for IBM and get health insurance and a pension plan. My God, I knew a lady who did that and she was on drugs. It was so boring.
Well, for the wrong person, it certainly would be. For the right person, I'm sure that's great.
And I had nowhere to go back to. I don't want to waste a lot of time talking about the Lakens, but honest to God, they all should have been either in prison or in hospitals.
So you came from roots that you were shaking that dirt off your shoes.
Oh, it was way more than dirt. My parents thought my songs were noise, and the only thing that radios were good for was news. And when I graduated from college and I sat in my father's garden playing my ukulele and singing and writing new songs, my father came storming down the hill after work every day and said, "Did I send you to college so you can sit here and make this racket for the rest of your life?" And I said, "Yeah, that's pretty much it." So I had to get out of there, and he threw me out in the snow. And I never went back, and I never had anywhere to go back to. Mm-hmm. So I had, my ukulele and I were joined at the hip. I never left the house without it. I spent every night sitting on the floor of my little single apartment with moss green high-low carpeting and wrote new songs till my fingers bled. And every Friday night, I went to the Troubadour Club in Hollywood and listened to Carole King and James Taylor and Anne Murray and Linda Ronstadt. And I thought, well, here I am sitting 20 feet away from these people. I want them to sing my songs. And I knew if I just figured it out, I could get there, because my songs were as beautiful and as catchy as the ones they were already singing.
Where do you think you got that confidence, Molly? Because it sounds like it certainly wasn't endowed of from your parents saying you've done terrific. Where do you think you got that?
I think it was survival. This is what I want to do. I have to do what I've been given gifts to do. And I have nowhere to go back to and no fallback position. So if I didn't do this, it was over.
Hmm. So desperation, huh?
I guess.
In a way.
I mean, when I was a kid in Canada, I used to turn on the radio at night and listen to WKBW in Buffalo, New York. Because at night, when the airwaves were clear, I could hear the whole top 40 from Buffalo, New York. Now, the Canadians, forget it, they were still playing Guy Lombardo. But I loved all those songs on WKBW. I knew all the words. I sang them. I took piano lessons, and I did very well. And then I took Minuet in G and changed the ending to dum 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 be dooby dum 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 dum, at which point my mother locked the piano. So I knew this was in me. I knew it had to come out. And this was my shot.
Wait, so explain that little tune you just...
Oh, that was Come Go With Me. I love you, darling.
Are you saying, did you write that?
No, but it was a hit at the time. And so here's Minuet in G with this ending. And my poor piano teacher, she couldn't speak. Molly, what are you... Are you kidding? I said, well, why not?
Why not?
I was a big believer in why not. Before there was a women's movement and before there were any quote-unquote rules. And so, why not? Why not?
It's a good question. That's a good question. You know, because I've been asking you, I've been sort of nibbling around the edges of you know, what decisions you made or how did you get this confidence, and you're unlocking it for me. You had that little magic, why not? Why not me? Why not? Why shouldn't I be a songwriter? Why am I waiting for somebody else to tell me I can do this? So it sounds like you just overrode all of the obstacles and hesitations and criticisms and from family, from the industry, from other people, and just said, why not? Why not me?
It's true. And it's very easy to squash an artist. You know that.
Yeah.
And when I became successful and had a lot of hits and was teaching at UCLA and had a special songwriting class for singer-songwriters, they were all really scared and timid. And I was their coach, man. I was their cheerleader. And I got them all going. And among my clients for the last 35 years, I have 12 Grammy winners and 19 Grammy nominees and thousands of other songwriters and singers and lyricists have placed their work in movies and TV shows. And
which is where you also placed work for TV theme songs. And
yes, I did.
Songs that became parts of movie soundtracks, I'm gathering, or...
That's true. And the first thing that ever happened for me that was easy was when I joined a cult. Now, if you can believe this, a nice Jewish girl joining a cult. Because the head of the cult said I had been chosen to be in this cult, and he said, I want you to co-write with this guy. And I said, okay, I guess I'll co-write with this guy. And I must have called him for 6 months, and he wasn't interested. Who was I? He had all these credits. And I remember calling him from the tennis club and reciting my lyric over the phone. And it was a lyric called Beautiful Sadness, at which point he wrote a melody to it. So if you can call that easy, I guess that was...
You didn't stay in the cult.
Oh, no. Well, that's another whole chapter. Well, but anyway.
We'll have to talk about another day.
So then a music publisher named Mike Stewart asked me to be a staff writer for him. And this was after I'd been thrown out of A&M and thrown out of Interworld. And he says, what can I offer you, Molly, that no other publisher can? And I had to think on my feet, and I said, I want to write themes and songs for TV and movies. And the next day, he had a meeting for me to see an ABC hour-long pilot, and it needed a theme song. So I watched, and I thought, this is really good. And I called the guy from Beautiful Sadness, and I said, would you like to write this theme? Because he had all these credits. They didn't know who I was. So we got that theme. And then that started the rest of it. I had some legitimacy.
And that became the theme song for what show?
Eight is Enough.
That was one I held fondly as a kid. Well, so,
thank you.
So it's... I'm seeing this development. I'm seeing this kid with a ukulele, right? This young girl, young woman with a ukulele, just trying to be a songwriter. And then eventually you busted past, you found a mentor or two that helped along and overcame the ones that weren't there. But then you eventually became what I'd call a songwriter's songwriter, right? You helped other people learn the way to find their dreams in songwriting.
Well, yes. When I was teaching at UCLA, I remembered what I went through. Now, I was lucky to have a mentor. His name was Mac David. And he was nominated for 11 Oscars and had 40 or 50 gold records. And he saw himself in me pushing to get out of... He came from Brooklyn, had nothing, was one of five kids. He went to law school. He dropped out to recite poems in Greenwich Village. Can you imagine? And so he saw himself in me trying, and he busted my chops to make sure that my craft was there and I wasn't using sloppy rhymes and then I was digging for things that were original. And to this day, I'm at war with cliches. But nonetheless, when I finally got to a place where I felt I had something to offer, I hung up my shingle as the song doctor, the song MD. And at one time, they called me the Dr. Ruth of rock and roll because I helped heal all the sick songs. You could bring me a song, I'd listen to it, or I'd look at the lyric and I'd say, well, this is wonderful. How about if we move this up, take this out, say this twice, and move that down? And I know instinctively how to quote-unquote fix a song.
Well, that's not unlike what an editor does for a book or a
that's correct.
Something like that. And sometimes it takes somebody outside of the creator of the art to polish it to the next level. Well, it sounds like it's been a really deeply satisfying career because you've done so much of what you knew you could do. You just trusted your own gut and your own dream.
I did that, and I especially was grateful to have songwriting as an outlet for my sadness. I was mixed up with this maniac narcissist film producer for 17 years, and when he was mean to me, I would just write a song.
Mm.
And believe me, there are lots of songs I wrote about him. And then when I was selling my home, my interior decorator said, I have a friend who is a businessman from Utah, and he's looking for a home in the area. He has an office down the street, and he wants to come and see your place on Monday. And I said, well, he can come on Wednesday when my housekeeper's here. Well, no, Molly, you don't get it. And I said, no, I'm not cleaning up my house for some looky-loo crackpot polygamist from Utah. Have him come on Wednesday. She says, Molly, you live on a busy corner and he has cash. So Monday, the doorbell rings. There's the decorator, and standing next to her is Robert Redford. And if you don't think I wrote some songs about him being in my bedroom, mercy.
And
remember that movie?
He wasn't a polygamist.
Remember the movie Indecent Proposal? So it was right around that time. And both realtors and all the escrow companies, we were all women fighting over who's going to deliver the papers today. You went last time. I don't care. It's my house. I'm going. So, yeah, I've had all kinds of adventures as a songwriter.
Well, and Molly, you are just an absolute fountain of amazing stories that I could ask about each one. But what I really want to thank you for and thank you for sharing here is just this notion of sticking with your dream and not letting people squash the artists and knowing that you need to do what you need to do to express yourself. I'm so glad that I got a chance to talk with you today, and I wish you continued success in every area. Thanks for being part of the Morning Glory Project.
Thank you, Betsy. And can I mention that if anybody's a songwriter and wants my help?
Oh, sure. How would they find you?
Please go to songmd.com. Song like sing a song, M like Molly, D like doctor, all one word, songmd.com.
Oh, good to know.
And I wish everybody a good day writing, a good day painting, a good day thinking. And don't you dare let anybody squash you. Mm. When you know that you got something special in there, you owe it to yourself and to the world to manifest it.
Ah, that's a wonderful place to end. Thanks so much, Molly.
Thank you, Betsy.
My chat with Molly Ann Lakin today, well, I just had fun. Isn't that nice? She is a character and she's had so many experiences. But what I really came away from my conversation with was just, again, that kind of morning glory determination. Boy, this is a woman who was going to climb over, under, around, and through any obstacle in her path to get where she wanted to go. She was going to overcome difficult family circumstances. She was going to overcome being in an era when women were not welcomed, what she was doing. She was going to bypass her own limitations and learn what she needed to learn and become successful in the way that she wanted to be successful as a songwriter. You may not ever write a song. You may have a completely different avocation and different kind of work, you may not even carry a tune. But that message of, you know, I'm just going to go do this. Why not? Why not? What does it cost us? Even if it doesn't work out, what does it cost? Just try. What's something that you've been saying you wanted to do and you haven't? What has fear held you back from doing? What has obligation held you back from doing? What has limited resources held you back from what you're doing? And is there kind of a way to grow that vine around those limited resources and figure out a way around them? There usually is. And with that, I'll call that the extra bloom. Thanks so much for listening to the Morning Glory Project. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbinder, and I'm so glad to have spent some time with you today. Now I invite you to find a way wherever you are, whomever you're with, to bloom.